I gave a reading once. There's an organization called the Associated Writing Programs. It's sort of the Modern Language Association of Creative Writers. It's a place where you go essentially to die. Or to kiss ass, one or the other. You know. But I was invited there. Actually paid to come and read. And I read a number of long, resounding, rotund, sonorous poems. And a friend of mine, I also read this dinky little crappy poem, and my friend, Stanley Plumley, came rushing up to me and he said, "Home for the Holidays is a marvelous poem." I wanted to kill him. What about those big, serious, sonorous, epic poems? And he said it again, "Home for the Holidays is a wonderful poem. You should send it to the New Yorker." I said, "They'd never take it." "Oh, yes, they would." I don't know if he's got some kind of pull. They did. And they didn't change the language. For example, it begins, "Does anyone give a shit?" Now, that's not the usual poem in the New Yorker. I mean, how did Stanley know? Okay. "Home for the Holidays. Does anyone give a shit? Not I," said the little brown mouse. "And so to bed," said Mother. But no one was listening. "Praise the Lord," said the radio. The radio said, "Praise the Lord" again, and the television turned its back on the room. Turnips for wisdom, eggplant for beauty, parsnips for ease, cabbage for size, a raw egg for the hair, a slice of ham to seize the hips, for the nose, foxglove and salt, for grace, ice-cold water poured from way high up to way down low. Everyone sits at the big table in the dark. The empty plates, moon. The silverware, stars. The napkins scrub their hands. "I'm home," says the front door. The windows are deep in thought. The roof has taken off its hat. Nothing to do, chance the toilet. Yeah. Stanley was right. It's probably the best poem in the book. Every year, somebody, I forget who it is, it's a guy who teaches at Smith, publishes a book of sort of spiritual poetry. I forget what he calls it. Maybe it's just spiritual poetry. And every year I'm in it. And I am the least spiritual person you will ever meet. I mean, I love things. I really do. I don't want an hour with God. I want a new chair. My typing chair is awful. Yeah, I want relief from my pinched nerves. I don't want a vision. And finally, I sit down and I write a truly religious poem, and it doesn't get in. I don't know. I don't know what he's doing. Anyway, some of you may not know where the Williamsburg Bridge is. It's in Brooklyn, and if you cross it, you get to Manhattan. Unless you're in Manhattan, and if you cross it, then you're in Brooklyn. There's a kind of reciprocity about New York. For example, if you were to jump in the East River, you wouldn't get wet, because there's no water in it. You would just smell foul. Yeah. Okay, houses in order. In cardboard boxes under the Williamsburg Bridge, a congregation of mature rats founds a new order based on the oldest religious principle. They eat whatever they can get their teeth into. By day, they move slowly about their kingdom. Some days so slowly they seem for hours on end to become holy relics or the stained brown backgrounds to events foretold in parables to do with the savor of salt, the mysteries of mustard seeds, meat, bones, loaves, and fishes. When you look back, they've gone into water or air. They've joined the falling rain that makes vision so difficult, even for the visionary. The little houses keep their secrets, the way windowless houses always do, though their walls and roofs proclaim the hour's holy names, Nike and Converse, Panasonic and Walkman. And though they let light leak in through their teeth-torn ports and darkness out from under their lids, they're closed to all but the eyes of the faithful. These dull pilgrims contemplate the business of gathering and hunting while the day hangs on and the traffic drones on the bridge above. Soon the headlights come on, singly or in pairs. The rain gleams through the taut cables. No moon rises above the island, where now they are among us, each one doing a morsel of God's work until their small jaws ache with so much prayer. Let me change the tone entirely, for at least for one poem. This is from The Mercy. When I went to college, the new philosophy was logical positivism. And the people who preached it, they were like the people now who preach literary theory. They know everything. And everything that came before ain't nothing. And I, who loved Kant and Plato, and the existentialists, I was an outcast among philosophers. I was banished. I pumped gas. They had no aesthetics anyway. Most of them didn't eat, and that's why they don't live anymore. They hated digestive processes. So this is called philosophy lesson. And I was into the existentialists at the time. Philosophy lesson. After driving all night long, I stopped for coffee and eggs at a diner halfway to New York City. The waitress behind the counter looked up from her magazine and said, "Look who's here," clapped her hands together and broke into a huge smile. "Have I been here before?" I asked. "Beats the shit out of me," she said, and put a glass of cloudy water in front of me. "What'll it be?" One war was closing down in Asia to be followed by another. No longer a kid, I wondered, who was I that a gray-haired woman up all night in a roadside hole would greet me like a star? "What do you think of Sartre and the existentialists?" I asked. "We get the eggs fresh from down the road. My old man bakes the bread and sweet rolls. It's all good." It's not often you get the perfect answer to such a profound question. On the way back to the truck, I listened to the pebbles crunching under my wingtips. Watched two huge crows watching me from a sad maple. Smelled the fishy air blowing in from Lake Erie and thought, some things are too good to be true. I didn't stop writing just because I published a book. Some people do, you know, they publish a book and the publisher says, "Tomorrow is the publication date." And they sit there waiting, you know, like the phone's going to ring or, you know, there's going to be a clap of thunder or something momentous is going to happen. And my image is, it has all of the power of throwing a nickel into the Pacific. You know, you look out, did the ocean change? It looks pretty much the same. But in the long run, something does happen. So I never stop writing. I just keep writing, bad or good. You know, I mean, I write. That's what I do. This poem grew out of an, a kind of wonderful experience. After a reading, I visited a class. I don't remember what school it was at. And a student said, "What was the best job you ever had?" Because I write about work. It must have been after I wrote What Work Is, a book I have by that name. And I started thinking about what was the best job I ever had. And I remembered that I once had a job that I didn't have to do anything at. And I got paid pretty well. I worked for Railway Express, which was the UPS of the Stone Age. And I was working there for a while, and then one day I was notified that I was supposed to go with a particular driver. Well, this guy said to me, "I'm going to have an operation in 2 days. And so today I'm taking you out on my route, and you will do that route for 3 months, and then I will come back." And we drove to a parking lot. And he parked the car. We had loaded the truck with a few things. And he said, "Do you like to drink?" And I said, it was about 9:30. And I said, "Yeah, but not at 9:30. And he said, "Oh, well, I'm going to that bar over there. I'll tell you what. Meet me back at the truck here." The truck was parked behind a brewery. "Meet me back here at 3 o'clock. And we'll finish our day's work." So I met him. I actually went to the library. And I came back. And he said, "We're going to get back a half an hour late. We're going to have some overtime today. Because I had to show you how to do the job. Tomorrow, when you do it for the first time, I want you to be an hour late. And then gradually, you know, 50 minutes, 40, 30, I don't want them ever to know that I don't do anything. And if they find out, I'll kill you." And that's how this began. It was absolutely fabulous. There are references here. Prince Mishkin, of course, I'm in the library. It's called Library Days, because it was the only time in my life when I got paid to sit there and read. Prince Mishkin is the main character of Dostoevsky's The Idiot. Jane's book of Fighting Ships, it's a book that lists warships, and they bring it up to date. You can read about all, you know, cruisers, battleships, whatever. You know, Turgenev's here, Chekhov is here, War and Peace is here. But you've all read that. Library Days. I would sit for hours with the sunlight streaming in the high windows and know the delivery van was safe, locked in the yard with the brewery trucks and my job secure. I chose first a virgin copy of The Idiot by Dostoevsky, every page of which confirmed life was irrational. The librarian, a woman gone gray though young, sat by the phone that never rang, assembling the frown reserved exclusively for me when I entered at 10 a.m. to stay until the light dwindled into afternoon. No doubt her job was to guard these treasures. For Melville was here, Balzac, Walt Whitman, my old hero, in multiple copies, each with the aura of used tea bags. In late August of 1951, a suited gentleman reader creaked across the polished oaken floor to request the newest copy of Jane's Book of Fighting Ships, only to be told, "This, sir, is literature," in a voice of pure malice. I looked up from the text swimming before me in hopes of exchanging a first smile. She'd gone back to her patient vigil of the dead black phone. Outside, I could almost hear the world. Trucks maneuvering the loading docks or clogging the avenues and grassy boulevards of Detroit. Other men, my former schoolmates, were off on a distant continent in full retreat, their commands and groans barely a whisper across the vastness of an ocean and a mountain range. In the garden I'd planted years before, behind the old house I'd long ago deserted, the long winter was over. The roses exploded into smog. The African vines stolen from the zoo strangled the tiny violets I'd nursed each spring. The mock orange snowed down and bore nothing, its heavy odor sham. Not for heaven or earth would I trade my soul. Rather would I lie down to sleep among the dead. Prince Mishkin mumbled on page 437, a pure broth of madness. Perhaps my part, the sole oracular part in the final act of the worst play ever written. I knew then that soon I would rise up and leave the book to go back to the great black van waiting patiently for its load of beer kegs, sea trunks, and leather suitcases, bound for the voyages I'd never take. But first, there was war and peace. There were Cossacks riding their ponies toward a horizon of pure blood. There was Anna, her loves and her deaths. There was Turgenev with his impossible histrionic squabbles, Chekhov coughing into his final tales. The trunks with their childish stickers could wait. The beer could sit for ages in the boiling van, slowly morphing into shampoo. In the offices and shops, out on the streets, men and women could curse the vicious air. They could buy and sell each other. They could beg for a cup of soup, a sandwich, and tea. Some few could face life with or without beer. They could embrace or die. It mattered not at all to me. I had work to do. This July, I picked up the paper one day. It happened to be July 12th. And I read that if he were still alive, it would be the 100th birthday of Pablo Neruda. And I said, holy cow! Because I was married on the 50th birthday of Pablo Neruda. And that day, I was married 50 years to my present wife. Nobody else. I was so stunned by this, by what a great day it was for poetry. I mean, my modesty just fled, you know? There I was, Pablo and I. So, I wrote a poem about it called I Was Married on the 50th Birthday of Pablo Neruda. Neither of us knew how crucial a day it would become in the history of poetry. He was in Paris, in a bistro, sipping a chilled Moulin Avent with his mistress, waiting for the chef, a Catalan he'd favored since 1939, to deliver on the promise Monjetes con Butifarra he'd yearned for all that lean day. While I was in a courthouse in Boone, North Carolina, staring at a poster of three auto wrecks and the one word, think, in blazing red. The circuit judge who just asked me, do you plight your troth? Seeing my befuddlement save the day. Quote, just say yes, young fella, and we can all move on to what you've been waiting for. I always like to read the last poem I wrote, no matter how, you know, no matter how good, bad, or indifferent it is. Prévert is a French poet, he's mentioned in here. Miguel Hernandez is a great Spanish poet. Michaud is another French poet. You know what a Lacoste is, it's one of those shirts with the little alligators on it. David Bear is my cousin, now dead. His name was David Bear Prishkolnik. He was my father's younger brother's son. He lived in Nîmes, southern France. He was essentially a peddler. It's called the French have a word for it. Oh, Alicante is a city in southeastern Spain. Once was a real working city. It's now largely a resort for the English and the Dutch. The French have a word for it. Prévert describes Alicante as one hotel room with his lover's garments strewn on the carpet. No doubt they woke at dawn to see the winter sun rising out of the mother sea and felt the day was designated theirs alone. Others must have felt otherwise. My failing cousin, David Bear, half broken in the war, drove all night from Nîmes with his Arab sidekick to escape his monumental wife and flog fake Lacoste at the street fair. The French have a way with words. Prévert goes on to tell us his bed pulsed with his beloved's breath. Later, the sea accepted them joyfully. Even the drowned sang while the sky above blued as never for anyone else. Michaud was there, too, disguised as a truck tire, come full circle. And Miguel Hernandez in the black wings of an avalanche of street birds. And Teddy, my young son, who wakened to coffee, churros, and oranges, and cried, "Me!" The world, in its glamorous, shabby guises, belongs to anyone with 10 fingers, more or less, and a voice that demands. The voice of David Bear, for one, hawking shirts to the wives of workers who don't know a Lacoste from a cream puff.